What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss. This week marks the 2024 National Day of Mourning, or as many people on this land now refer to it, Thanksgiving. We'll spend the hour with indigenous voices from the Bay Area to Colombia and as far away as Palestine with speeches and performances from an event this past Sunday, November 24th at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley called Things Taken, Rethinking Thanksgiving. It's an annual event whose purpose is to challenge the colonial narrative of the holiday and to recenter Native organizers and cultural workers. We'll start with the host and MC of the event, who is also one of our hosts at KPFA's show, Bay Native Circle. This is Morningstar Gali.
Morningstar Gali, ilk atake chi'i, ma'ajumawi is chi'i. My name is Morningstar Gali. I'm a member of the Ajumawi Band of the Pitt River Nation. I'm located up by Mount Shasta, covering Shasta, Siskiyou, Lassen, and Modoc counties. I was born and raised here in the Ohlone Bay. I was born at the Aim for Freedom Survival School that is also known as the Oakland Aim House. And so it's how I received my name, was during a sunrise ceremony. And for the past 16 years, I've been coordinating the sunrise gatherings that have taken place on Alcatraz Island. And so that will be this Thursday from 5 to 8 a.m. The first boat is at 4:15 a.m. I've gotten messages from lots of you that didn't get your tickets, and tickets have now been sold out for a couple of weeks now. We've sold over 4,000 ferry tickets, and there is a capacity of 5,000 on the island, and so 500 tickets will be available. I'm gonna say that tickets have been available since September 2nd, so for next year, please get your tickets early. Because as much as I would love to interact with all 5,000 people there on the island, it's just not possible in terms of answering all the last minute ticket requests. And there's really only 2 to 3 of us that support with the coordination efforts. And so for those that aren't able to make it, you can listen to KPFA. It will be live streamed on KPFA 94.1 or at kpfa.org. And you can listen to the live broadcast, but I just wanted to share a bit of that information. And that is a sunrise gathering that has been honoring the original occupation of Alcatraz Island from 1969 to 1971. We have some occupiers that are here in the audience with us this evening, and so I want to give a big O to them. Chris Longoria, who was out on Alcatraz on Wednesday, celebrating the 55th anniversary of the occupation that took place on November 20th, 1969. These are our relatives that are still very much with us today, still very active in the San Francisco Bay Area Indian community, and continue to support us and guide us in our organizing that we are continuing to do. So we were, as we all know, right, in terms of talking about Turtle Island, that we didn't create the borders, that the borders crossed us, and that we are imposed, the imposition of the borders affects us as Indigenous peoples on a daily basis. And so Indigenous struggles and land back struggles go beyond these created borders, and our next guest is here from what we now call Colombia, and she's joining us to talk about her work protecting an island off of the coast of her homeland, her country, and she's doing work here locally with Amazon Watch. And so please give a warm welcome to Zia Mata.
Some of you know my story and have been along supporting my heart in the journey back to my people and the place that I came out of the earth from. I am a Muisca woman from occupied Colombia. Muisca territory is in the Andes Mountains, over most of so-called Bogota, which is the capital city of Colombia, and stretches north of Bogota. I am from a stolen generation. My mother was tricked by Child Protective Services, who knew that she couldn't read or write, to sign her fingerprint, signing away her rights to her children who were stolen and taken to CPS by our babysitter who didn't want to do her job. Much of my work has been seeking how to use my voice here for my relatives in the South in making connections between our fights on the ground in South America and the financial institutions and places of power that prop up these destructive projects and continual practices of abuse. Whether it's asset managers like BlackRock using people's retirement investments without their consent to finance extractive projects, violate indigenous sovereignty and human rights, or state governments seeking to finance military projects like the proposed US military base on Gorgona Island in Colombia, we have a responsibility to speak up. Now, I didn't go to college, and finance is a difficult subject, so I know that if I can get a basic grasp of it, then any one of us brilliant, intelligent, and creative people can do that. I just returned recently from the UN Conference on Biodiversity in Cali, Colombia, where I was part of a self-organized delegation participating in the BOICOP, made up of Muisca people from the Suba Muisca community, defending Humedal Tibabuyes, the largest wetland in Bogota, from greenwashing and destruction like draining it and filling it with sustainable concrete to make it seem cleaner for ecotourism. Exactly. I also participated with a delegation of community defenders and marine biologists from Isla Gorgona participating in the COP itself. The BOICOP was an alternative presence of the people who are never invited to these conferences, who don't have the support of large NGOs, and whose voice often gets drowned out by the popular fights that are front and center. We sought to bring those voices to the front and say, until we are all unifying and amplifying all of our fights across all of our people, we will continue to be divided by colonial systems that would see us battling for funding, for attention, and unwittingly taking part in the climate Olympics. Whose fight is worse? We witness the scarcity mindset that leads us to exclude each other as we forget that we're all related in this fight for our Mother Earth. The current president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, is the first progressive president we have ever had, ever. His vice president is one of us, of the people, an activist and warrior for Afro-Colombians named Francia Márquez. Petro just finished hosting the COP, where he spoke extensively about recognizing that indigenous people and Afro-descendant people defend the rich, unique biodiversity of the Pacific coast of Colombia, and speaking to the world about fighting neoliberal imperialism, particularly the United States. Not 15 days later, the Congressional Court of Colombia lifted a stop hold implemented last December on the construction of this US military base and submarine station on Isla Gorgona due to a lack of free prior informed consent and consultation. They decided we don't need to do free prior informed consent. Isla Gorgona is also known as the Alcatraz of Colombia because it was also once a prison. And it is one of the only places in the world where it is illegal to chase the humpback whales that migrate through, along with dolphins, sea turtles, and multiple whale and shark species. And as such, it is a haven where they feel safe enough to come up to the coast and jump and dance and have their babies and sing so much that you can hear them from your hotel room on the mainland. Construction has already begun installing a radar tower on the highest point of Isla Gorgona, which is a sacred site for the 8 coastal communities who belong to Isla Gorgona, where no one is supposed to even go.
Shame.
Yes, thank you, shame. We have been saying to Petro, who has the power to stop this project with one word, how can you host an international conference on peace with nature and then turn around and violate the rights of Afro and indigenous communities by revoking their rights to free prior informed consent? How can he preach to the world about being against militarism and in solidarity with our relatives in Palestine and then turn around and allow this unneeded military base and call those of us resisting it in defense of Gorgona terrorists who are against national security? I have newly been pushed into this scary-ass free fall of following the guidance of my ancestors to do this full time, and I'm in the process of collaborating with a variety of community-led resistance groups, contributing towards building campaigns in English to connect our struggles and to show how the Amazon is connected to the ocean, it's connected to the mountains, we're connected to the moors and the bays and all of our sacred lands of beauty. We want to find and create ways to show up in solidarity, doing our part in the Eagle Condor prophecy from north to south in the ways that we have always been in relationship with each other. And you can find and follow us on Instagram at WeProphecy as we build this bridge from scratch. And I want to invite you quickly, because I know I'm running out of time, to sing a little tiny song with me. Do you feel like you can do that?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to sing the line. You're going to sing it back to me, okay? Amazing. How do you make a bridge?
How do you make a bridge?
It's built of many days.
It's built of many days.
Starts with a single step. Even when you are afraid.
Even when you are afraid.
Starts when you're speaking up.
Starts when you're speaking up.
Starts when you're standing tall.
Starts when you're standing tall.
Build a strong bridge, my friends. No one can make us build a wall.
No one can make us build a wall.
No one can make us build a wall.
And that was the voice of Xiomara Chingate, a member of the Muisca tribe in what we now call Colombia, speaking at an event from this past Sunday, November 24th, at La Peña Cultural Center called Things Taken, Rethinking Thanksgiving. On today's show, we're featuring selections from that event, featuring the voices of indigenous activist organizers and cultural workers from around the world. The next voice we'll hear is Desiree Harp, a member of the Mishawa Wapo Tribal Nation. She is a singer, songwriter, community organizer, and educator. Desiree co-facilitates the Mishawa language classes and cultural gatherings, and she works at the Sonoma Ecology Center to educate the community about how native plants, animals, and waterways are interconnected. Desiree is also involved with Chief Kaline Sisk and Karina Gould to help coordinate the Run for Salmon campaign and prayer journey to restore the California waterways, salmon runs, and indigenous ways of life. Here's Desiree Harp.
Ikali keep me inomahnok se'e mishual. Hello, I come from the Mishual Wapo people, and I am here today to share a song with you, but I'm going to need some participation. Somebody actually asked me to write a song to say how I feel about the times that we're living in. And so this is really my way of saying that not only are we the return of our ancestors, but also we are fulfilling all these prophecies that say that we are going to be that light in the darkness. And so this is just a song to remind us of our power, because it's really important for us to remember how powerful we are. And so when we believe that change can happen, change will happen.
This pain, they try to sweat it off, but it's through tears we cleanse the depths of our souls. We put up dams inside our hearts. We block the love when we don't let the water flow. I know life can get so heavy. It feels like our hands are tied as the world crumbles around us and we're tired of the fight. It was prophesied that we would be the lights inside the storm. When we shed what isn't ours, we transform. Fly away, fly away, fly away. Fly away, fly away, fly away, fly away, fly away. We're so afraid of the unknown. We grow and we release our need to control. Healing is so uncomfortable. It takes commitment, strength, and courage to endure. I know life can get so heavy. It feels like our hands are tied as the world crumbles around us and we're tired of the fight. It was prophesied that we would be the lights inside the storm when we shed what isn't ours. we transform. Fly away, fly away, fly away, fly away. Fly away, fly away, fly away, fly away, fly away, just like a butterfly. Fly away, fly away, fly away, just like a butterfly. Fly away, fly away, fly away, just like a butterfly. Fly away, fly away, fly away, just like a butterfly. Fly away, fly away, and breathe.
And for those of you just tuning in, we're listening to audio from an event from this past Sunday evening, November 24th, at La Peña Cultural Center in Berkeley called Things Taken, Rethinking Thanksgiving. We already heard about indigenous struggles here in the Bay Area. We already heard about indigenous struggles in South America. Indigeneity knows no borders. The next guest that we'll feature from that event, Things Taken, Rethinking Thanksgiving, is Chris Juanis from the Palestinian Youth Movement.
I'm part of the Palestinian Youth Movement, so I want to talk a little bit today about the connection between indigenous and Palestinian struggles here on Turtle Island, all the way to Palestine. And it's called Things Taken, right? So we got to talk a little bit about so-called Thanksgiving. And what the real story is, you know, Thanksgiving, we've been sold is a story about cooperation and harmony, and that's what we hear here in American public schools. But really, we understand it in its true political origins as one rooted in violence, one rooted in dispossession, and settler colonial domination, nothing less. So the real story of Thanksgiving begins in 1637 with the massacre of the Pequot people. So when English settlers came to so-called Connecticut, what did they want? Expansion of territory and an ethnic cleansing of the indigenous people who posed resistance to them. So 1637, 700 Pequot men, women, children are massacred in a village close to what they called the Mystic River. And following this massacre, the English settlers declared a day of victory and celebration over their massacre of the indigenous Pequot people, and that's what they called Thanksgiving. So let there be no mistake. What is seen as a harmless celebration is really a celebration of a genocidal act of violence. And it's an attempt to rewrite that history to the settler narrative. Thanksgiving is nothing less than an imperial tool that reinforces myths that settlers claim that colonization is somehow a moral act, that somehow they can absolve the settlers of their responsibilities to the atrocities that they have committed and continue to commit. But we know that the attempts by the empire are really in vain because we're not fooled. And we know the lies. We know that the true face of the so-called United States is one of a genocidal settler colony, and they can't hide that from us. So we have a duty today. We have a duty every day to critique this settler holiday and recognize instead the long history of indigenous struggles. We have a duty to support indigenous-led efforts to reclaim land, culture, and sovereignty. And in every instance in which it comes up, we have to challenge these colonial myths and teach accurate histories of one, the brutality of settler violence, and two, the dignity and resistance that indigenous people have always held in the face of settler violence. Thanksgiving, rather, should be about indigenous resistance to the barbarism of colonialism. And it's a testament that the history of indigenous resistance paves the way in our roadmap to liberation. Because we as Palestinians, We know what settler colonialism is. And we know it can never be moral, it can never be principled. We know that alongside our indigenous brothers and sisters and siblings, that we share a lineage of struggle. We know that the indigenous communities here on Turtle Island are also survivors of genocide, survivors of ethnic cleansings. And these are all tenets that we understand as Palestinians who are facing an ongoing genocide as we speak. And we understand that through these shared experiences, that we have a necessity to be in joint struggle. We have a necessity to stand in unity when we face an enemy as big as U.S. imperialism and settler colonialism. Because we too are indigenous, but we understand indigeneity is not just because we have been there. It's not just because we come from the land of Palestine, but because the land creates us as we are. And it's because not that we have a sense of purity through blood quantum or through genetics, but because our indigeneity comes from a political duty to defend our land. It comes from a duty to protect our people wherever they resist against settler colonialism. Because we came from the land long before settler colonialism or the Zionist entity existed. And that land gave us our sense of identity, our steadfastness, our bravery, our courage to be able to face disproportionate violence. It's that land that allowed us to look down the barrel of a gun and see God and see victory. And it's the land that carries the spirit of hundreds of thousands of martyrs, Palestinian martyrs, indigenous martyrs, that has allowed our seeds to continue to grow and embed us with that same spirit of resistance that our martyrs have held. One of the core pillars of Palestinian resistance is an idea called tarakum in Arabic, which means accumulation. And it means an accumulation of all of the spirits who have come before us, everybody who has sacrificed their lives. Martyr in Arabic is shaheed, which means witness. And they're witnesses to the brutal violence that ended with their death, but they're also witnesses to the incredible resilience and resistance that led to their sacrifice. And we understand that we are filled with the spirits of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that have resisted since the British came, but not just that. That we are learning and continue to learn from 500 years of indigenous resistance here on Turtle Island. The key to any successful struggle is to understand the necessity of the lessons our elders have given to us. But the enemy makes it difficult. What happens to our elders? Oftentimes they're assassinated or imprisoned, and we lose connection with the history of our struggle. But that's why we need to understand the importance of history, the importance of study, so that we know that our elders, even if they are martyred, even if they are passed, they stand with us, and we have studied their history, we've studied their victories, their mistakes, their sacrifices, their character, and we can allow that to embody our struggle today. Because our elders, our ancestors, have not truly died if we carry them with us. So that's why we as Palestinians have understood the deep, deep necessity to be in joint struggle with our indigenous brothers and sisters. And that history isn't just today. I mean, let's talk about history. Let's talk about the history that they'll never teach you in schools. From the 1970s, the Palestinian Liberation Organization saw the work that AIM was doing here on Turtle Island, and they were actually invited to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in 74 for the first International Indigenous Treaty Council. And what did they do there? They were there to protect them. They were armed. They were security. They were making sure that whatever infiltration, whatever the feds or the governments did to try and infiltrate those council meetings, they were willing to sacrifice their lives and protect their indigenous brothers and sisters here. And that connection didn't end in the 70s. It continued day after day between AIM, between the PLO, and today through the PYM, The Palestinian youth movement has understood this necessity so deeply. We sent a delegation to Standing Rock to help water protectors. But we understood it's not just national campaigns, too. Here locally, with the Save West Berkeley Shell Mound, Run for Salmon, and amongst many other local campaigns, we have an intimate connection because our liberation struggles are tied. We will not be liberated until all indigenous people are liberated. Because it's not just a responsibility we have to our own land. We have a responsibility to the land of all indigenous people. And it's a duty for us in the struggle for liberation for Palestine to stand and fight shoulder to shoulder with our indigenous siblings. Because wherever there is indigenous resistance, we must support. Wherever there is indigenous resistance, we understand that our struggles are connected. And they're part of that accumulation of knowledge. And us fighting today, we're going to continue to add to that accumulation. And we will plant the seeds for the next generations to grow up. And inshallah, grow a stronger movement than what we've been able to build. Because when we fight against imperialism, when we fight against an enemy that is so grave and big and outweighs us in terms of their power and domination and brutality, we have something they can never have. We have steadfastness. We have unity. And we are aligned in the political principles of building a future. And that's what organizing is. It's future building. Because we are imaginaries. We create and we understand that we need to be able to create a future that we might not be able to envision or grasp right now in this moment. And that's what land back is. Land back is a deeply political act. Why? Because to the settler colony, land is everything. It's their land base from which they can extract materials for war, from which it launches its wars of domination. But without that land base, the U.S. empire could never exist. And that's why they know the people who have the deepest connection to land are their first victims. But we're also those who will never stop resisting. So, recognizing indigenous struggle means working to bring land back under indigenous care and confronting U.S. imperialism in all its forms. Land back is a relationship with Mother Earth, where indigenous people are its stewards. Land back is moving our people towards liberation and sovereignty through a political movement. Land back is recognizing the long legacy of our warriors, leaders, and martyrs who have sacrificed their lives for the liberation of our land. And land back is acknowledging that only when Mother Earth is well can us, her children, be well, because we belong to the land. And land back is not just an idea. It's a reality. And it's a movement that has existed for generations. It's the return of the Duluwe Island to the Wiyot tribe. It's the Esetlin tribe reclaiming 1,200 acres of their ancestral homelands in Big Sur. It's the centuries-long fight to reclaim the Black Hills. And this is something that Bill Means said himself. The Black Hills are not for sale. And the Black Hills are their Jerusalem. Because when the so-called United States offered the Sioux $17 million, what did they say? The Black Hills are not for sale. Because sometimes it's bigger than just a check, and that's something the settler can never understand. Our land has no price tag. So when Bill Means went to Palestine, and he saw the importance of Jerusalem to us, he understood that him and Palestine would forever be connected. Because no matter what money they throw at us, Jerusalem has no price. And the Black Hills has no price. Because we have dignity, we have principles. And our land is not something that can be bought. For us indigenous people, land ownership is not something understood in a capitalist way. It's not that we use land and exploit it for its resources. But we know that people are the land. We have a responsibility to the land, to fight for it, to caretake it. So we know
The land doesn't belong to us, but we belong to the land. And we are extensions of it, both materially and spiritually. So let me leave you with these last words. We as Palestinians, we're not the first indigenous people to fight against colonization, and we won't be the last. We remain committed to fighting with our indigenous relatives here on Turtle Island until we can all realize the dream of land back and show that it's not just a theory. It's something we will realize within this lifetime or the next. But together we ground ourselves in the wisdom of our ancestors, in the wisdom of our martyrs, and the commitment that our elders have showed time and time again for this struggle. Because the greatest threat to the enemy is the unity that we show as indigenous people. The greatest threat to them is that we will never give up, that we have a steadfastness that will outlast any administration, that our duty is to the land. So for as long as our land exists, we will resist. Thank you.
And that was the voice of Chris Juanis from the Palestinian Youth Movement speaking at Things Taken, Rethinking Thanksgiving, an event at La Peña Cultural Center from this past Sunday, November 24th. Today's show here on Law and Disorder features a variety of voices from that event, indigenous peoples discussing their struggles, organizing, and activism practices from around the world. The next voice we'll feature is Ashley Rojas, the Policy Director of Indigenous Justice. She'll be talking about the work of that Northern California organization.
My name is Ashley Crisal Rojas. I'm the Policy Director with Indigenous Justice. Morningstar founded this organization from a series of individual fellowship awards that she won in response to incidents of violence in her own community. And she's grown that into what is now a standalone 501c3 organization. It's a really huge accomplishment of her individual like love and labor for community over the last 8, 9, 10 years, 15 years. And we're super proud to work with her and to work for her and to continue to forward her vision for Indigenous justice for California tribal and intertribal communities across California. We have absolutely continued to develop out the scope of work with missing and murdered Indigenous peoples. We have the privilege to partner with the City and County of San Francisco to pilot what is the first of its kind guaranteed income program for survivors of violence. We're giving 10 Indigenous survivors of violence in San Francisco $1,000 a month for 12 months. And building evidence to forward that moment, that movement, and grow it across the state as non-carceral strategies to address intimate partner violence, gender-based violence. And so we're really excited about that. We're about midway through, and that the report on that reports are super exciting to people like me. We'll be available in the summer of next year, where we'll be able to talk about all of the impacts and how much opportunity has come from that. And so that work continues to grow, and we do lots of statewide policy work for MMIP. We recently passed what's called the Feather Alert, so you might have seen some of those alerts come out now. So when an Indigenous person goes missing and is when a person goes missing, the CHP will coordinate an alert which mandates that they expend resources to find that relative. Because in the past, we were having a lot of issues with folks not being searched for. You might have heard like missing white woman effect or like the Gabby Petito case where like every resource was expended to look for Gabby. But when Native women go missing in those same very places, Native people go missing, there's not as much of an investment made to find them. And so with policies like this, we can hold state and federal systems accountable to expending their resources to bringing our relatives home. And if you've been by our table tonight, you've heard me talk about what is the STRONG program. It's our most recently developed program. STRONG means siblings taking responsibility for our Native generations. This is a youth organizing program, building power with and for Native young people, tribal and intertribal communities across California. And this program has always been supporting Native young people. We've just sort of invested into it more in this last year with anticipation of the incoming federal administration, because in their horrific document, Project 2025, they've outlined in details the ways in which they intend to execute an assault on tribal communities, including defunding education, defunding Head Start programs, which serve about 400,000 Native babies across the country. They're talking about defunding Title I schools, which are low-income funding for low-income schools. Title VI, which provides cultural supports to Native young people. Defunding services for disability, student supports like IEPs, which we can anticipate will lead to more arrests and incarcerations of Native youth on school campuses. And so we're organizing to collect data from data and experiences from Native youth across California so that we can hold our state government and our Department of Education accountable to protecting and defending Native youth, regardless of what the federal government decides to do. So here in California, we're saying protect and defend Native youth. And so you can find more info about that at the table way over in the back there. Another program that we're super, super grateful to be able to be building out, again, in response to direct relationships in our communities, is our coworker Luigi is building out a program called Returning Relatives. It's the first of its kind program for bringing home incarcerated and supporting formerly incarcerated Native peoples as they return back to community. So if you have a relative who's behind bars and needs spiritual support, community support while they're incarcerated, and resource them upon their transition so they're successfully reintegrated back into community, reducing recidivism.
And that was the voice of Ashley Rojas, Policy Director for Indigenous Justice. We're listening to audio today on Law and Disorder from the Things Taken Rethinking Thanksgiving event that took place at La Peña Cultural Center this past Sunday. That was November 24th. We're going to close out today's show with words from Vic Montana and Deja Gould from the Segurite Land Trust.
And so we just want to invite people tonight to this Friday's walk that we have put on, Vic and I, for the past, this will be the third year, the Shell Mound to Shell Mound walk that starts from one of our sacred sites, the West Berkeley Shell Mound, to the Emeryville Shell Mound that's at Bay Street Mall. But we wanted to give you all a little bit of background that about that walk.
So we'll start a little bit with some history of the first walk. 3 years ago, there was a pause for the walks because of COVID, and me and Deja kind of went up to Karina. We're like, are we having a walk this year? And she turned around and asked us, are we having a walk this year? So that's a responsibility that Deja and I took. So the first walk was held three years ago in honor of the ancestors that have been here before us, the Lashon Ohlone ancestors. For someone that's, you know, for someone that's a guest here, I think we could show, I try to show an example of what it's like to uplift those ancestors and tell people the name of the village that we're on, that we're living on, that we're all like occupied, that we're guest on. And so that walk was dedicated to uplift the memory of those ancestors of the Lashon Ohlone, and also to uplift the spirits of the Creeks that have been coerced and have been diverted from their natural routes, as well as all of the animals and the insects, and from the smallest microorganisms to the way that the water has been shifted because of all this infrastructure.
So again, these demonstrations that we have held for many years came out of the walk that started in 2005, where we walked from Shell Mound to Shell Mound every year around Thanksgiving time. For 4 years, starting in 2005, we walked the Shell Mounds that were documented by Nels Nelson in a map in 1909 that documented over 425 Shell Mounds in this area, in the Bay Area. And Shell Mounds for us are our sacred sites, which I feel like a lot of you all know that already. And so that went for 4 years. And then after the walk was done, we decided that every year, the day after Thanksgiving, on the biggest shopping day of the year, we would demonstrate outside of Bay Street Mall that, again, sits on top of one of our largest shell mounds.
And one of the most shameful things is to those developers that desecrated that shell mound, like they just said the largest shell mound, like they literally have the audacity to like build like a small representation of like what a shell mound is. So if for those of y'all who have been there, I don't know if y'all seen like the smallest mound that's supposed to uplift the history here of my relatives, and it's unacceptable. Last year, we dedicated the Shama and Shama walk in solidarity with our Palestinian relatives. Our struggles are intertwined, they're braided together. And, you know, the West Berkeley Shellmount is the oldest visitor site as well as a gathering space. So, sort of in a way, it still serves that purpose. For me, that place has been a place where I actually learned about Palestine. I learned about Mauna Kea. I learned about what's going on in the Amazon. There's been so many people from all kind of interfaith people there that have gathered in that place to shoulder support to preserve that place. Last year, about 4,000 people showed up. We were able to shut down the Bay Street Mall for over 5 hours.
So this year's walk is dedicated to our elder Wounded Knee Del Campo, who passed away. Wounded Knee has been monumental in the protection of many sacred sites, not just for us, but for people all around the world. He was the longest walker, part of every single longest walk, and he completed all of them. Wounded Knee was one of those people where if you asked him to show up, he was there. The reason that occupation happened at Segorite in what is now known as Vallejo was because of him. It's because he reached out to my mom and he reached out to Janella LaRose that that site was occupied for 109 days. Had it not been for him, we might not have been able to protect that site. So this year's walk is dedicated to him and all of those who have come before us and all of those who are coming after us. We want to uplift him in all of the work that he did and all of the work that people are doing to protect their own sacred sites around the world. So, again, we want to invite everybody here to come to that demonstration, that walk, that prayer walk, that is a 3-mile prayer walk starting at 1900 4th Street at the West Berkeley Shell Mound and walking to the Emeryville Shell Mound at Bay Street Mall. We want to invite people to come and set those prayer downs because every step is a prayer. Every time you walk in these walks, every time he walked in those walks, every time somebody has had a walk to highlight these places, they're a prayer. And so we want to invite everybody to bring your prayers to that walk that's going to happen on Friday. So please come if you can. Again, it's 3-mile walk from one shell mound to the next. And so if you can imagine,
and those were the voices of Vic Montana and Deja Gold from the Segorite Land Trust. They were speaking at an event which we've heard many selections of audio from today, from Sunday evening, November 24th, called Things Taken, Rethinking Thanksgiving. You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a world where all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is co-hosted by me, Jesse Strauss, and Kat Brooks, and produced by me as well. Our show theme music is from Steve Raskin. Feel free to hit us up about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media. That's at lawanddis, D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you stream podcasts by searching for Law & Disorder with Kat Brooks. You can also find our content live on KPFA Radio or streaming at kpfa.org in the 8 a.m. Pacific hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by listeners, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.